Okay, well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to our first half 2019 financial results. I think we're a few down stuck on the tube, so if we get interrupted all the way through, then apologies, and apologies for those who had to dial instead of be here in person. Just to kick off, I just want to say thank you to Morgan Stanley for hosting us. And to simplify your lives, we're going to put the speech online straight after this, so you'll be able to pick up off the website. You don't have to take quite as many notes, quite as fast. I just want to say I am so proud and excited to be presenting today. Just the next stage of our journey. This is a great business with real potential, and I'm pleased with the progress that we've made in the first half. So why don't I start by summarising the first half on slide 4. With a backdrop of a highly competitive motor market, we have delivered a good financial result. We're on track to meet our financial targets, helped by the diverse business model and the cost and underwriting discipline. Operationally, we've hit some of our key milestones on our path to transforming our competitiveness and strengthening our ability to grow sustainably. Now, Neil will go through the financial details a bit later and give a little bit more context on the market environment. But just to summarise the performance, we continue to grow our direct own brand policies while maintaining underwriting discipline, and we've delivered a combined ratio of 92.5%. As you know, reducing costs is a major lever for us to be more competitive. So I'm pleased to say that we're on track to achieve our operating expenses of less than $700 million for the full year. This discipline has meant we could deliver a good operating profit of $274 million, resulting in an annualized return on tangible equity of 21%. We've grown our interim dividend 2.9% to 7.2 pence, leaving us with a strong solvency position at the top end of the risk appetite range. We've also made great strides in our operational and strategic journey. On the operational side, we've launched 3 new IT platforms in the first half, key milestones on our multi-year journey, and I'll talk more about those shortly. And strategically, I've used the first few months as CEO to challenge ourselves and to look beyond the next couple of years and ask, are we focusing on the right areas so that we will thrive well into the future? So what have I concluded? Well, I believe we're investing in the right areas and our business model is the right one and, in fact, an advantaged one to capture the opportunities that lie ahead. And our IT transformation aims to enable efficiency, pace of deployment and flexibility, all of which will be required to capture those opportunities. So we must operate and organise ourselves in a way that takes full advantage of that, and this is a priority to me. On slide 5, I'd like to take a moment to paint a high-level strategic picture. Our aim is to give peace of mind to as many customers as we can through our multi-brand, multi-channel, and multi-product approach. We achieve this through distinctive strengths that mean we can reach more consumers and offer them more choice. We have trusted brands built over many years and innovative propositions that give us valuable relationships with our customers. Our data and insight give us the opportunity to create value for our customers and our shareholders. Our vertically integrated claims model gives us advantages on claims costs, enables industry-leading propositions, and gives us good insight on claims and car technology trends. And we have talented and passionate people. You can see this with the 3 new executive appointments I made last month, homegrown talents who, between them, have nearly 35 years with the organisation. And this talent runs all the way through the business. For any of you that have visited our site or have used our customer services, you will know firsthand the quality of our people. Looking to the future, though, I expect consumers to demand easier journeys and personalized products. And with this in mind, I believe that our comprehensive channel strategy equips us well. Having a direct channel gives us a relationship with our customers, which allows them to better understand in a unique way their needs and meet those requirements. As a result, direct is a real driver of value for both our customers and our shareholders, and is a channel that will continue to be very important to us. The intermediated channels, such as price comparison and partnerships, are both significant and evolving as well. On price comparison sites, we're good, but we want to be great. And we expect the nature of partnerships to evolve. Combining our partnership skills with the strength of our brand means that we can create real competitive advantage here. Now, there are two critical enablers which, when combined with our strength, aim to underpin sustainable improvements in our competitiveness. And they'll help us respond to customers' evolving needs. The first is technology transformation. I've said to many of you before that with our legacy systems, it can be difficult to compete profitably in commoditized channels like price comparison. Here, cost, speed, data, and flexibility really matter. So I'm excited by the technology capabilities that we're developing to improve our competitiveness. The second is business transformation. To realize the full benefits of our new technology and grow the business, we need to work in a different, more agile way to deliver a faster deployment of change. Over the coming slides, I'm going to focus on the IT platforms we've launched this half, the benefits we expect to get from them, and give a glimpse as to how the transformation of IT is fueling the transformation of our business. So on to slide 6. Here, we're trying to show the overall IT platform picture. You can see I'm not exaggerating when I say that we are transforming virtually every IT platform in this business. 2019 has seen us achieve some significant milestones, but actually we've been steadily building and delivering for some time now. As you can see on the slide, each program is at a different stage, and it's in its delivery, and with benefits likely to emerge at different timescales. Our investments aim to materially improve our competitiveness for both the market as it is today and to set us up for the future. Of these, the most significant of the program is on our motor and home portfolio. We expect the benefits from this to start to emerge from next year. And in a similar way, our commercial broker business, NIG, is already starting to benefit from a string of platform improvements to strengthen its pricing and underwriting capabilities. Some of our other investments have the longer term more in mind to enable us to access and serve our customers in new ways with new products. Direct Line for Business, for instance, is now well established and has the potential to grow profits meaningfully over the medium term. Travel, which focuses on partnerships today, offers promising opportunities in the future, particularly in providing another touch point with our customers. And Darwin, our new approach for price comparison customers, is already giving us insights that could offer another growth opportunity. Within the next couple of years, we expect to have implemented changes on nearly all our major insurance platforms, to have reshaped the way we work as an organization, and to be well on the way with our IT infrastructure. And all of this is designed to deliver benefits through reduced costs, faster and more accurate pricing, greater product flexibility, and greater pace of change. So let's take a look at some of the individual platforms. On slide 7, we show the very high-level delivery program for our major motor and home platforms. Through this program, we're upgrading nearly all of the applications used in the customer journey, including policy administration, billing, pricing deployment. We're upgrading the claims system, and we're shifting most of the data onto the cloud to provide a more flexible and resilient data storage. In short, we're doing a lot. As a result of this, the customer will benefit from things such as online documentation and seamless quote journeys, more product choice and flexibility, more accurate pricing, more targeted marketing through faster pricing capabilities, and new, more granular data. We're progressing well on this, having launched Privilege Motor this half to both direct and on our first price comparison site, with the others following shortly. A phased rollout is designed to enable us to do this in a fast, safe, and controlled way whilst minimizing the disruption to the rest of the business. Once we've delivered the key functionality across motor and home, we'll then have the flexibility to expand the product range. We'll have the ability to start to break products down into smaller components and to build more personalized products, delivering them more quickly and more cheaply. Overall, the new platform is giving us all a real sense of excitement and optimism for the future. Now on to Darwin on slide 8. From the outset here, our ambition was to combine the benefits of our scale and data with a new approach to pricing, designed specifically for price comparison and to increase our pace of learning. We wanted to use the latest digital and data techniques to create a pricing model that doesn't overlap with the group's existing model. And we wanted to do it with a cost base that would give it a competitive advantage. So we pulled together a team of data scientists and data engineers, gave them the group's data, and provided them with the support and scale of our claims team. Now, we're managing the rollout very carefully by placing limits on numbers so that we can test and learn, and I'm pleased with the progress. The rollout will take some time, and as it progresses, we'll see the degree of overlap with the main book, and this will give us a better sense of the scale of the growth opportunity. But the group is already benefiting as it learns from the Darwin team's working methods. And the main book is benefiting from Darwin's detailed information in areas such as application fraud and risk modelling for customers with claims and convictions. Now on slide 9, I'd like to tell you about travel and our new partnership with Starling Bank. Starting on the left with travel. We have totally transformed our travel platform, building a system that is fully optimized for tablet and mobile, provides online medical screening and self-service upgrades, and is fully automated for certain claims. Delivering this has helped secure the renewal of both our RBS and Nationwide contracts. But it also provides interesting options in the future. It provides potential another touch point with customers and lends itself well to emerging distribution platforms. Moving to the right-hand side of the page, and our partnership with Starling Bank. We've mentioned our API capabilities in the past when we discussed our home proposition with RBS. I'm delighted that our strengths here have enabled us to combine our Churchill brand and our partnership strength to be the first major insurer on Starling's marketplace. It's small volume today, but we're already learning what we can do in this environment, and there is potential to access valuable data to improve the customer experience here. So as you saw earlier, we're transforming our largest business line with the aim of to grow our profitability over the near and medium term. But also you can see that we're investing in the long term so we can meet the evolving needs of customers. On slide 10, we show you the evidence that we can successfully grow businesses. Some 12 years ago, we launched Direct Line for Business, and today we have 500,000 customers and over 100 million of premium at good and steady margins. As you know, over the past few years, we've invested in building the next generation system to give small business owners the confidence to buy their insurance direct. Those of you who came to the Bristol office last year heard a little about the way we work in BLCB, which is a really agile working approach and gives the team pace and real customer focus. Now, they continue to seek to optimise the current product suite and customer journeys, and I am always excited by their innovation and their energy. They've made good progress to date and have further product launches planned in the second half. And Rescue is also undertaking a lot of activity under the surface. Re-engineering the way people work, building a centre of excellence with multi-skilled teams, successfully relaunching the Rescue Me app, renegotiating supplier contracts and so on. The list is long. And we continue to see great potential in Rescue. And in the second year of its five-year plan, we've completed its progress. Look, I hope that I have conveyed there is a real buzz and sense of ambition within this organisation. We've made excellent progress, but as you can see, there's a lot of change going on, which I just can't do justice to here today. So we'd like to share more with you at a Capital Markets Day on 21st November. Now, we'll be holding this at our largest contact centre, which you can see behind us in Doncaster, to bring to life for you some of the things that are so special about BLG. As an exco, we love to go to our contact centres, to feel the extraordinary energy of our people there and to see in their season in action their commitment to our customers. But we'll also provide you with some insights on the capabilities our new technology brings and how we're using them to transform our business and bring competitive advantages. I'm really proud that we've been able to deliver so much change while delivering good financial results this half. And with that, over to Neil to do the financials.
Thanks, Penny, and good morning, everyone. Now, I was talking to Andy the other day, and I realised that over the last 15 years, I've been to over 300 results presentations. I know many of you in the room have maybe done a few more than that. I know that the presenters always look forward to my constructive feedback. So I very much look forward to yours. So let's start on slide 13 in the pack. For me, the summary today is good results on track to meet both our 2019 targets and our medium-term combined ratio target. Before I go through the results in detail, I'd like to talk to two key themes that these results highlight about our model, our discipline, and our diversification. Discipline shows through in both the trading results and our cost story. In motor and home, we priced the claims inflation in what were highly competitive markets. And our operating expenses are at the lowest level since the first half of 2015. The value of our diversification is also showing through with over 100 million of profits from outside of the motor business, as well as continued strong premium growth in Green Flag and direct lines of business. These factors have enabled us to report another good operating profit, which in turn has helped us grow the dividend again, all supported by a very strong capital base. So all in all, a good first half financial performance. Now for the details starting on slide 14. Operating profit was 274 million in the first half, lower than last year due to a few significant items, most of which we highlight on the table at the bottom right of the page. On the positive side, weather has been very benign compared with last year when we suffered the beast from the east. But there are a few items going the other way. Most important is that you'll recall we had exceptional motor performance in the first half of 2018, which benefited from price increases as a result of moving to an Ogden discount rate of -0.75%, while still benefiting from the pre-Ogden reinsurance costs. Last year, we also had a gain on the sale of our Bristol office and high investment gains. This year, we've had lower gains, a more normal motor market, and the confirmation of the new Ogden discount rate, which has cost us £17 million. Now, whilst profit is down in the first half of 2019, a combined ratio of 92.5% is a good result. If we normalise out the weather, we get to 94.6%, of which about a point is Ogden related. So underlying 93 to 95% is well within our range of 93 to 95%. As Penny mentioned, return on tangible equity is close to 21%, despite a more conservative solvency position than usual and well ahead of our target of 15%. Moving on to in-force policies on slide 15. Overall, we saw flat in-force policies in the first half and premiums down 2.2% as our diversified business model helped offset some of the pressure we saw in motor, starting with our direct own brands in-force policies. Motor, which represents just over half of our direct own brand portfolio, was down 1% since the start of the year, with most of this reduction coming through in the second quarter. This reflects our discipline, and I'll talk more about pricing later on. Home policies were broadly flat in a highly competitive new business market. In terms of channel performance for motor and home, we had some good growth in PCW, particularly through Churchill, but with market shopping levels generally down, we saw fewer opportunities in direct. Green flag continues to grow, with policy count up 5.9% year to date, again achieving double-digit growth year on year. The team here has built great momentum and is looking to pass 1 million customers by the end of the year. Moving to commercial, direct line of business grew to over 500,000 policies, with volumes on the SME platform doubling in the period. The table on the right shows what's happened outside of direct owned brands. Policy count fell in motor and home partners, which is due to the partner exits we've talked about before. Rescue partners and other personal lines were primarily lower due to package bank account volumes, a trend we've seen over a number of years. And in NIG and other, the team are focused on improving margins, particularly in motor lines, and this has led to lower volumes. Now, before I move on, I'd like to focus a minute on the long-term trends of our direct own brands, because it's evidence of our ability to grow in the most valuable parts of our portfolio. We've grown in motor when the time is right, and our diversification has balanced that when we've needed to hold discipline. You can see that since 2015, we've grown our motor own brand policies by 13% and delivered 16% growth across the rest of our own brand portfolio. This gives me the confidence in our ability to grow over time. Now to the segmental results, starting with motor on slide 16. Motor delivered a good result and continue to trade to target loss ratios in a highly competitive market. Overall, operating profit of £154 million was £86 million lower than prior year, primarily due to the reversal of last year's exceptional underwriting performance. You can see this in the current year loss ratio, which increased by 4.9 percentage points to 83.4% and returned to a more normal level. Prior year releases have reduced, consistent with our purchase of more reinsurance in recent years. This reduction also reflects the increase in reserves for the move to minus 0.25% Ogden discount rate. You'll recall we are reserving at 0% at year end. Turning to top line, headline GDP is down 4.7%, but with only a modest reduction in IFPs. Underlying this is a reduction in risk mix due to several pricing updates at the end of last year and improvements in addressing application fraud. On top of that, our free legal expenses proposition on Churchill is performing well in the PCW channel. Collectively, these actions reduced average premium, but have enabled us to find pockets of value where we were able to maintain our margins. In terms of claims trends, underlying inflation is still at the top end of our 3 to 5% long-term range. Within that, Third-party property damage remains high, but has stabilized after a poor first quarter. Inflation here was in part due to the pressure in the motor repair industry from high accident frequency in 2018, but the start of 2019 has seen that pressure ease. And to remind you, we believe our auto repair centres continue to give us competitive advantage on damage claims. On slide 17, we show the latest ABI premium data. We said at the four-year results in March that we were that while pricing had stabilised in the second half of 2018, we were disappointed that the market as a whole was not pricing the claims inflation. Since then, we've seen one or two positive data points, but to date, this has not turned into sustained market pricing improvement. As we stand here today, there are two market trends that insurers will need to make judgments on. First, the upcoming whiplash reforms, and second, the new Ogden rate, which was worse than the 0 to 1% range most in the market were expecting. While we can't predict how the market will go from here, our approach is unchanged. We remain focused on maintaining our pricing discipline and will continue to prioritise target loss ratios over volume. And while we can't be immune from market pricing pressures, we remain committed to investing in the business with the aim of delivering benefits on cost and underwriting that mean we can, to some extent, carve our own path. Let's look at home on page 18. The first thing I'm sure you'll notice is a big jump in profit year on year. Whilst benign weather is the main cause of this, the team has also done a great job improving the normalised combined ratio by around 2 points compared to last year. This has been achieved by a determined focus on pricing, underwriting and claims actions, particularly in relation to escape of water. Whilst we still expect long-term claims inflation around the 3 to 5% range, our latest experience has been better than this. Moving to the market, we believe that most are broadly rating the claims inflation, but there remain a small number of players that we see come in and out of the market with more aggressive pricing tactics. Against this backdrop, we've traded in a disciplined way around PCWs with targeted growth where we see value and pulling back where we don't. And overall, we've achieved rate increases of 1.5% and a continued reduction in the risk mix. It's also worth noting the commission ratio, which continued to fall and is starting to find the appropriate level following the exit of two partnerships in 2017. So in summary, 71 million of profit supported by strong underlying performance. Now, slide 19. As you can see, commercial and rescue and other personal lines, between them, contributed 49 million, around 20% of group profits, beginning with commercial. The segment continues to see growth in top line, with direct lines of business up 8%, partially offset by a flatter picture NIG, as it continued to focus on margin improvement. Rate carries in the first 6 months for renewed business was around 6%, with the strongest improvements in motor lines. Importantly, the current year attritional loss ratio improved by a point due to the margin focus and pricing initiatives at NIG and a greater weighting towards direct line for business where loss ratios are lower. Overall, it delivers a 32 million operating profit. Rescue and other personal lines, profit increased by a little over 2 million to 18 million pounds. This result was largely driven by rescue, which saw a 10% improvement in operating profit to 21 million. There were two key drivers of this growth. First, the earned through of higher green flag direct premiums from the previous year, which improved the risk mix away from partners. And second, better claims frequency following last year's adverse weather. As I said earlier, Green Flag is beginning to show some real momentum and is well positioned to win in the rescue market. turn our attention to costs on slide 20. As you're aware, and as Penny mentioned, we are not satisfied with our current cost profile. And over time, we're looking to sustainably reduce this and have over 90 initiatives in train at the moment. These cut across the whole expense base and include the investments we are making in the transformation program, many of which Penny has already talked through. The current core areas of focus include self-service and digitalization, process improvement and automation, as well as more traditional forms of cost cutting in terms of procurement activity and managing cost leakage. And you can see the results of some of these actions coming through in the first half, with operating expenses down 16 million to the lowest level since the first half of 2015. Of particular note is the reduction in marketing, where we have again improved effectiveness. The expense ratio was fairly stable, as these lower costs were offset by lower earned premium. Given the phasing of levies, including Flood Re in the first half, we are confident of delivering operating expenses below 700 million in 2019. The next slide, 21, pulls together the underwriting ratios in one place. So I've already talked to the headline combined ratio of 92.5% and the 93.5% underlying for Ogden and Weather, which is well within our target of 93-95%. So I'll move on to the main purpose of this chart. This is to show that we've delivered consistently strong combined ratios over time. And again, demonstrates the DOG model and the benefit of a disciplined approach to underwriting and a diversified portfolio. Moving on to the investment result on slide 22. Lower assets under management and lower gains led to a 20 million reduction in the headline results. The net investment income yield was up a little at 2.1% due to lower hedging costs and was slightly ahead of the 2% expectation. We are still confident of achieving this expectation for the full year. Looking further forward, with reinvestment yields down year to date, it's difficult to improve the 2% from here in the current environment. As expected, gains were much lower in the first half compared to the first half last year. We recognise net gains of 12 million as we consolidated mandates with a view to reducing investment fees. As you can see on the table on the right, last year's gains were supported by fair value adjustments on the property portfolio, which did not repeat this year. This was expected, given conditions in part to the UK's commercial property market. To remind you, our portfolio is prime and has a relatively low exposure to retail. On a more positive note, the available for sale reserve has improved from an unrealised loss of 37 million at year end to a gain of 27 million at the end of the half year as credit spreads narrowed and interest rates fell. Our guidance for significantly lower gains in 2019 is unchanged, and I'm not expecting any further gains for the rest of this year. Now to the group's capital generation on slide 23. In the first half, we saw a small reduction in the SCR, which reflects our reduced risk exposure. As we said before, we expect this to continue given the greater use of reinsurance than in the past. Our capital has also been supplemented with positive mark-to-market for narrowing credit spreads since year-end. Moving across, capital generation is broadly consistent with IFRS profits, so no surprises there. And penultimately, capital expenditure, which supports the group's transformation program, was 90 million, around half the four-year guidance of 175 million. Finally, we grew the interim dividend by 2.9% to 7.2 pence per share. And the end, the half, was strong capital surplus of around a billion, up around 120 million from the full year. So on to the solvency ratio on slide 24. After the interim dividend, it's a very strong 180% and is at the top end of our risk appetite range. You'll recall at the year end, we held back some capital to form a buffer against heightened political and economic uncertainty. This buffer has increased in the first half, helped in part by the tightening of credit spreads. We said at the full year, we keep this position under review, and since then, environmental factors haven't improved. Therefore, we are not returning any additional capital today, and this leaves us at the prudent end of our risk appetite range. Under normal conditions, as you know, we still expect to operate at a ratio around the middle of the risk appetite range. In the future, we will also consider the most appropriate mechanism for returning any surplus capital and may utilise share buyback if conditions are appropriate. So before I hand back to Penny, I'd like to close with the outlook and targets on slide 25. We're confident that we can again deliver a combined ratio within the 93 to 95% target normalised for weather. We've made good progress on costs and are on track to reduce operating expenses to below $700 million this year. Investments are also on track to generate 2% net investment yield with no further expectation of gains in the second half. And as you've heard from Penny, we're making great progress with our transformation agenda, which is underpinned by the $175 million of capital expenditure in 2019. Thank you, and back to Penny to wrap up.
Thanks, thank you. So what are the key messages I'd like you to take away today? Well, first, whatever the market conditions, we will remain disciplined and long-term focused. This is a key ingredient in our objective of sustainable, attractive returns. And the results today in highly competitive markets are a testament to that. Second, we're a business with different sources of earnings through different products, different distribution channels, by different brands and propositions. And this positions us well for steady earnings and dividends for our shareholders and meet customers' evolving needs. Third, we're on track with our operational change agenda and are well down the IT transformation path, albeit there's plenty still to do. Across the group, we're moving towards newer, faster ways and more flexible ways of working to realise the benefits from the new technology, and then to unlock the potential of our people and leverage the group's existing strengths. And fourth, this management team is excited by our plans to deliver a material change in the capability and efficiency of this group, and we look forward to telling you more about that on the 21st of November in Doncaster. And with that, I'll hand over to you for questions.
So, thank you, Penny. Thank you, Neil. We'll go to questions in the room first, and I'll start on the right-hand side.
For those of you on the phone, if you would like to ask a question.
So, start with Andrew.
Morning, all. It's Andrew Creed. I just have three questions. Investment income, you know, if interest rates remain here, can you sustain 2% into 2020?
If interest rates remain here, can you sustain a 2% investment income yield into 2020 and 2021? Secondly, with your pricing up 2% and claims, average claims up 5%, how long, if it stays like this, can you maintain your confidence in a 93 to 95% combined ratio? And finally, on the special dividend, I understand political uncertainty, but in and of itself, it has no impact on you. The impact is if credit spreads blow out. Credit spreads have tightened, so why hasn't a special dividend been paid, which was owed to the market at last, the final? And under what conditions, given Brexit is deeply uncertain, will you ever start to move on that?
Do you want to take investment income?
So I'll go first. For investment income, reinvestment yields are down year to date. I agree. If we look at our maturity profile performance through the next 18 months, we should be able to maintain the 2% based on current yields. Obviously, if yields move from here, that will change.
Yeah.
Pricing, look, I mean, our approach is to price to a target loss ratio. So we will price into the 93 to 95. And the thing that gives, if it has to give, is the top line, rather than that. So we will keep focused and keep pushing towards that 93 to 95 and are confident of doing that. This is why we've reiterated those targets. On dividends,
I'll start. And I'll finish. So look, nothing has changed from the policy. The policy is still the same, 140 to 180, normal conditions operate in the middle of the range. You know that we tend to hold more capital at the middle of the year because the profile, because we generally look at capital at the year end only. This year we did say we'd look at the half year. But as I said a minute ago, we don't see the factors changing. And we're still within the range. I think it's not a bad thing to be conservative at the moment. Inherently, we are a fairly conservative company. But don't read too much into that in that conservative, but we also have a very strong track record of returning capital when it's appropriate. So, I mean, I don't need to say that we've returned, I think, $2.5 billion since IPO. So the credentials of the company are the same, and the track record, I think you should be comfortable that when it's appropriate, we will return the capital.
Yeah, look, this board, all committed on returning capital to shareholders. I think what gives us pause around this is simply this. We all do a huge amount of work around capital models, creating 100, 1 in 200 scenarios, building them up, actuarial. When you face into binary dislocation events, you just need to be prepared for that. And none of us know what credit spreads will do in those environments, and we do know that we're sensitive to them. And that's the piece that we are really, really protecting for. But we will absolutely keep this under review. We don't see it as a permanent state of affairs. We do believe that the middle of the range is the right place to be. And our shareholders will benefit from that.
Thank you. Go to Dom.
Thanks. Dom O'Malley, Exan BNP Paribas. Three questions as well from me. So the first, just on motor claims inflation. You specifically highlighted third-party repair cost inflation, and your competitors have also focused on third-party. Why is it third-party, not total repair costs, that are really the issue here? You mentioned, obviously, the issue about, the advantage you have in own repair network, but I'm wondering if it's more than that, whether there's actually some sort of structural driver of a difference between third-party and sort of own policyholder accident claims. The second is on capital generation. So Neil, you specifically said capital generation is roughly in line with IFRS profit. On the face of it, you might have guessed without seeing that number that it might be lower because PYD is an important contributor, and PYD under IFRS is not necessarily the same as PYD under capital. Does this imply that actually capital generation should improve versus IFRS as your mix moves away from PYD to a low expense ratio? And then final question is a bit more broad about the motor environment. We're all sort of looking out for the green shoots, as it were, cycle to turn. I think from an investor perspective, one of the challenges is it's difficult to know or to judge what could cause that turn without having some good explanation for why we've had a sort of a deterioration or sort of an intensification of competition. What's your best explanation for why the market has been disappointing in terms of rates? Thank you.
Thanks, Dom. TPPD, it's been up and down a little. I think we have good evidence to suggest that our internal the repair centres do give us a cost advantage. I think you partly saw that in the back end of last year where we kind of did better through quite a difficult period for damage effects of the market. We called out earlier this year in Q1 that we were seeing the third-party damage costs going up significantly. And they've definitely stabilized in the second quarter. And what we weren't sure of at Q1, because it takes a little bit of time to understand what the shape is when severity goes up, it can be because of an underlying structural issue, or it can be because frequency is putting pressure on, whether it's credit hire, cost, or supply, or whatever. So severity can go up as a result of frequency moving. And I think there clearly is underlying high damage cost inflation across the board because of structural effects, but I think what we're seeing in Q1 with the frequency-driven increase in severity costs, if that makes sense. And that's what we think is going on. That's why we think it's evened out a little and stabilised in Q2. And it remains the case that we believe we get better value out of our repair centres than we do out of third parties for whatever reason. So I think that's damaged. Do you want to do capital?
I just think, yeah. So I'm trying to think, I don't think there's anything particularly in there of note. Obviously, one of the main differences is amortisation will be in one out the other one, which I'm sure you've adjusted for. I think we've been reserving, obviously one's discounted, one's not, so that can create some slight differences in phasing. But I don't think there's anything massive in there that is a disconnect in the first half. We could maybe have a chat offline, but I don't think there's anything in there to call out. Looking forward, there's no reason why, as PYD reduces, you would expect a disconnect. It's all coming out of the actual best estimates, which underpins both the numbers.
And why is the market... look, I don't speculate on why other people do what they do. Clearly, we are pricing and we're getting some clawback in the risk mix that we seek to. The one thing I will say is that, and I've said this before, there's been so many external stimuluses to the market through Ogden and Whiplash on its way, that actually even two people rationally looking at the situation together might make map a different course through that. So I still don't necessarily see it as a long-term, you know, structural problem. I think we'll know better once Whiplash comes in and how, you know, how the shape of that responds. But I, you know, you'll have to ask my competitors why they're doing what they're doing.
Go to Cameron.
Hi, it's Cameron from RBC. Three questions. The first one is on, you talked about the transformation technology. Talks about Darwin, it all points to a growth thing from the PCW. In the longer term, I guess, do you expect your market share to change markedly from here? The second question is on Ogden. Last time out when the rate was set at minus 0.75, no one actually was paid at minus 0.75, so the implied impact is not as bad as the, I guess, the, you know, just putting the math through on it. Do you expect that to be the case this time, or any thoughts on that? It's very, very, very early. And the third question is coming back to Andrew's comments around solvency ratio. Under a hard Brexit, is 180 the new 160? Thank you.
Short answer to the last one is no. So, no. So, transformation, look, what we are trying to do is create competitive advantage. We've certainly been at a disadvantage due to RIT in particular, not only, but in particular price comparison because of some of the features I drew out earlier. So our job here is to give us the competitive advantage. Whether that gets deployed as growth or loss ratio benefit, some of it will come through expenses probably anyway, but we'll determine a little bit as we go depending on what the market conditions are at the time. But let's get ourselves in a position where we're on the front hook, but we've got advantages others haven't got, and then, you know, that'll be, you know, then we can make that choice. Ogden. I think the market, well, we know the market was expecting somewhere between 0 and 1%, not least of all because the government had said it was likely to be between 0 and 1%. And most people, I think, moved their reserving into that range last year. We certainly did, and we absolutely weren't alone in that. And I think there's good evidence in the way pricing has moved over the last 2 years to show that most people were pricing for somewhere in that 0 to 1% range. Who knows where exactly? So minus 2.25, you know, whilst the fundamental most important thing is we all have certainty. So it's good for consumers that we have certainty, and it's good for businesses that we have certainty. So, we, you know, that's the main thing. We are a bit surprised we're outside the original range. We've taken a, you know, small hit here today, and I suspect, you know, pricing will adjust through the market as it always does for those things. I think the only other thing I say, they've left the prospect of a consultation on a dual rate out there. I actually think a dual rate is is a pretty sensible approach given the nature of the claim profiles and maybe the best route in the long run. So we'd be supportive of that happening. But it's more about the fact that it feels intuitively like the right answer than it's about a particular financial effect on us, I think. That's Ogden. We touched on solvency. Look, there is no change in the philosophy, the risk appetite. We remain as absolutely committed as returning funds to shareholders as ever we have been. We're simply trying to make sure we navigate with skill through any potential dislocation. Okay.
Thank you. We go to Drew, please.
Thanks. Drew Gaylord in HSBC. Three questions. Could I just ask about the dual pricing, the regulation from FCA? One, the update, as in, is there anything new which you're hearing? And secondly, what's the difference in profitability for you guys on, say, new business versus renewal on the motor and home business, number one? Second, just staying with regulation, whiplash reform expected next year. Numbers around benefits have changed, as in, we started with a bigger number, now we're down on those. There as well, as in, what is your view, as in, what could be the potential benefit for you? And lastly, in terms of reserve, now core target remains at 93.95. It has been benefiting from prior releases, which remains a decent sized number. How should we think of this buffer versus, say, last year on absolute numbers?
Okay, do you want to take the last one? Yeah. So, okay, dual pricing. I think there's nothing fundamental that has changed since the last time we spoke, but clearly there has been a lot of attention and press. The CMA have come out with some statements, the FCA has come out with an update on the consultation. But I think none of that is a sort of fundamental shift. A couple of moments, and what do we do? Let's start with what we do and then do a couple of moments on how we do the kind of industry position. I think what do? We do a number of things across our book for new business customers and for renewal customers because partly because we think insurance isn't just about price, it's about value as well. So whenever we give one of our propositions that we always talk to you about, whether it's a seven-day turnaround or a no blame, we do that for everybody in the book because we think it's the right thing to do to reward all of our customers for that. The second thing we do is we have our own internal pricing practices and standards, and within that we review every policyholder at renewal at 5-year point to make sure we're comfortable that their premiums are in an appropriate place, and that results in some cases in discounts, in some cases in premiums being frozen, in some cases there's no action required. So, but there is a clear review point. We pushed hard for last year premium disclosure because some of this is about transparency for customers as well as as well as the absolute pricing. And in our technology developments, we're doing a lot again to make policy journeys easier, to give more options on the way, and to make documentation much, much clearer and simpler. And so there are lots and lots of things we are doing internally to try and do our bit to try and resolve the situation. But the reality is we can't tackle this issue on our own. We have to do it as an industry because of the way the competition works and the way that new business pricing is heavily discounted, and most new business pricing isn't economically viable as a permanent price. So there is a structural point in this market, and so that's why we support the FCA doing what they do. We work extensively with the ABI in the development of their pricing principles, which are trying to create some framework to move insurers down a path to make this, to make this a better situation and improve the issue. So, and how do we feel about it? We think yes, I'm sure the FCA will make changes. It's not an easy issue for them because it's the competition in the market that is creating the particular issue that of concern here. But anything that they do that creates a level playing field, we're supportive of. And actually, when I look at us with a multi-brand, multi-channel distribution, a long history of writing successfully in the home market, I feel confident that we'll be able to adjust and thrive in whatever that marketplace is. It's just getting to clarity. That was quite good.
Whiplash.
So firstly, Whiplash benefits. The original business case, I think, was £35. I think generally we suspect that, A, that was done some time ago, the market's moved on, and we are, you know, sceptical that actually the benefits will be that high. Whatever the benefits are, they'll be passed on to customers. We've made that promise on the path. I think in timing terms, it feels as though the industry is pretty ready. The MIB sound as though they're pretty ready. There are still some bits that need to be sorted out about how the legalities of some, you know, are operationalized in some areas, and that requires MOJ time to get that done. So depending on the level of focus or distraction in the MOJ, I suspect is what will drive whether it hits April or not. We haven't given a specific number. We don't, for reasons of competition, give out specific components, but somewhere less than the original estimate, I suspect.
Reserving. Both gone. So I certainly think it probably helped with the shape of reserving for the first half. So if you look at where the reserve releases came, about a third of them were from 2018, a further third from the 3 years prior to that, and then a third from the tail. Kind of gives you a sense. As we're seeing most releases from the more recent years, I think it's important. Within that, clearly some of the releases in the tail will have now gained some maturity. How do we offset what we said will be a reducing prior reserve amount, not only because the book is smaller? I think it's three things, which is expenses, underwriting improvements, and ultimately some growth of the book. They're the three things, but they're the three key drivers to offset it.
The buffer change. If I don't buy that, then we haven't really heard much on this.
So the reserving philosophy is pretty similar. Clearly, the book is smaller than it was, so there's a quantum effect. So, you know, buffer in pound notes is different to buffer in how we reserve. So I don't think the reserving philosophy has changed.
Sam Tavis from Goldman Sachs. We're all obviously looking forward to the trip to Doncaster in November. But
as you should, yeah.
Well, is it possible to, you know, to say anything about your strategy to relating to partnerships already at this point, maybe? You know, it's an area where you've been losing a bit of volume recently. You know, what's the level of commitment here? What kind of things are you looking for? Then the second question is, you gave a roadmap for implementation or introduction of IT systems. Can you talk a little bit about switching off legacy IT systems as well?
Yeah.
Because I guess it's quite important for cost savings. And then finally, just on the buyback, you mentioned as a potential. What are the right conditions for a buyback? Is it just a question of a low enough share price?
Doncaster, you should relish the prospect of Doncaster. Very easy from King's Cross, direct train, and it'll be well worth the visit because we all love it. Partnerships, which I think is what you really wanted to know. Look, we do partnerships when the economics are right. So we some kind of partners value some of the service quality and the skills that we bring. When it's pure commoditized, traditionally we're probably less likely to be your player. So we remain interested in the right kind of partnerships. The point I was trying to make in the presentation is really that as time moves on, I think the nature of partnership arrangements is shifting. So it becomes more about making life easier for customers, using their data with their permission to make offers more tailored for them. And the thing that's particularly interesting to me about Starling thing is it's one of the first times we've been using our brand in someone else's marketplace, which, you know, you can see as being a development area for the future. And that's really interesting. So I think we are still in partnerships. We're still up for the right kinds of partnerships. We've just renewed two travel partnerships. They have to be on the right economics. And we think that whole world will evolve and we'd like to be part of it. In terms of IT and legacy, so we have I think I mentioned IT infrastructure. So we've outsourced the running of a lot of our IT infrastructure to a partner who's also the partner who's leading with us and working with us on a lot of the development, so that we run those two things in tandem. In doing that, we've contracted on a basis that gives us more variability of the underlying costs. So you're right, there is a stage down process, but that stage down process is mapped. It runs over the course of 7 years, depending what it is, but it seeks to move some of the benefits in so you don't get a cliff edge at the end.
Share buyback. So the first thing, this is a response to request from shareholders, thinking about how we return capital. We're not going to set out a really explicit framework, but to give you some idea, I think the biggest indicator of whether a buyback might be more preferable to a special dividend is probably the yield we're trading at the moment, the regular yield. So if the regular yield is very high, then adding to it with a special dividend might be more appropriate to buy back shares. But it's an open item on the agenda.
Thanks, John. Just three from me. Firstly, we've heard some comments around theft. What are you seeing there, and what proportion of your claims are theft in motor? Maybe something on CapEx over the medium term. What's the split between different businesses? I saw a mention of rescue. You building a big new system there with big risk of rewiring, etc. And then just going back to the point on capital, if you'll forgive me. You said, okay, fine, it's not 180, it's not the 160, but we've still got uncertainty at full year. Should we think that you're paying down to 180% instead of the 10 points buffer at 170% you said last year?
Theft is a pretty small part of the overall claims. The big claims components are bodily injury and damage. So it is running hot at the moment, so it is high. But not a dramatic effect, I think, in terms of the overall, and outweighed by movements on damage overall. CapEx, I'll leave to Neil. And just on capital, there's been no resetting in this process. We haven't reset our expectations of an endpoint. We haven't also sought to assess what those circumstances will be like at year-end, so we'll view that at that point.
So just out of theft, it's about 5% of the burn cost. So it's not a material amount for us. In terms of capital, Ben said the 180 is not the new 160. I think that it's hard to speculate what conditions we might be in at year end as we sit here today. I think you know what normal looks like, in that every point until the last dividend we declare, last year end, we consider it to be normal. So normal, I think, is reasonably clear. I can't say whether, as when we're sitting here in February or March time, the conditions will be a 160 condition or a 170 condition or a different number. I think we'll assess the conditions when we're at the point in time when we need to make the decision. But I think all we'd want to reiterate is the policy is very much unchanged.
CapEx. A lot of the CapEx is across the portfolio, so the big home and motor platform will be used ultimately for rescue as well. So there is some spend going on rescue, but not that dramatic in the scale of things. So so it's be the home and motor portfolios that take the vast weight of it, and supporting behind that is the sort of tech transformations and moving all of the infrastructure and so on, which obviously supports everything.
Right, that what we're hearing from others is 20-25%, so adding about a point to claims inflation.
Say again?
The ODI, I think they said theft up 22% or something. Sabre was saying 25%. Is it fair?
I wouldn't overread it, because I think you're seeing movement in other parts of the book, so it's one small part of, you know, 10 or so factors in the claims, and people, things are moving in different ways all the time. So.
Okay.
Thanks, Ed Morris, JP Morgan. First question, just trying to understand the expected sort of ultimate profitability of the business that you write today. Obviously, we've had changes in pricing, claims inflation, that seems to be quite a large delta currently. Can you just give us an indication of whether the expected ultimate is within the 93 to 95 and how that's evolved over the last few years? That'd be really helpful. The second is on, you mentioned if conditions remain competitive, that volume is likely to be the thing that starts to give from here. Do you see any risk that falling premiums might make it more difficult to reduce the expense ratio in ratio terms? And then thirdly, assets under management obviously have been declining as reserves have come down. How far away are we from the point where AUM should stabilize?
So, look, we target loss ratio to price into the 93 to 95 on an ultimate basis, so that's how we kind of set it up. So, that, I think, should give you the steer for that one. Expense ratio, so look, if we work hard to alleviate by focusing on different components, propositions, all sorts of things to alleviate the volume impact. But you're right, ultimately, if we take volume impact, we will act on expenses. So it creates an expense pressure in to the extent it's a fixed cost. That's an inevitable outcome. But we are, you know, super focused on expenses, whatever, so we're working hard on that.
So AUM, I think you're right, driven by reserve release, but also the reinsurance program as well, which buying more reinsurance means lower AUM over time. I think we're pretty much there, I think, on the AUM decline. Maybe, you know, there's a small amount more to go. And then I think it's much more linked to top line. So the potential, the future growth in the business will drive much more where the AUM is.
Okay. Okay, Ian.
Hi, Ian Pearce from Berenberg. Two questions from me, please. Firstly, you cited the auto repair network as sort of being a competitive advantage on insulating you from some of the claims inflation factors on the market. Could you just remind us of the number of auto repair centres you have and what sort of proportion of your own damage claims actually go through your own network? And then on the IT spend, it sounds like quite a lot of the initiatives focus on new business competitiveness. So do you see the main benefit of this IT spend coming through in boosting growth, or is it more an efficiency sort of element and the cost savings that these programs could generate that you see the main benefit coming through? Thanks.
So we've got 20 sites at the moment. And I think it's just over half of our repairs go through those. They're our own repairs, not third party. They're our own repairs.
About 100,000 a year. Look, IT spend should benefit renewals and new business. So it's not designed to, swing one way or the other. So I think everyone, all customers should benefit from that, and the business reflecting all of it should benefit. It's a combination, so there are clearly efficiencies. We do lots of manual workarounds today that we won't have to do in the new world. You've had examples of automated claims that increases efficiency. There are lots and lots of efficiency examples. The biggest benefits will come in terms of what I would call competitive advantage in the marketplace. Whether we take those in terms of kind of loss ratio, bottom line, or use those to reinvest in growth, I think just depends on the dynamics at the time when they're tools before us. So, yeah.
One question left. On the Ogden impact, I was wondering if you have any early estimates of how that may affect your reinsurance plan.
Short answer is no. I mean, there are lots of things that go into the reinsurance assessment pot, so we don't know exactly what people are modelling in their reinsurance models, but so too early to tell, I think.
Just come back to Ed, and then we'll go to the phones after Ed, unless there's any other questions in the room.
Thank you. One follow-up question. So we've seen some others in the market introduce new product structures, 3-year fixed, for example, renewal price guarantee. Is this something that you've done a lot of work on, and do you think ultimately the market will go in that direction?
When we think about, you know, whether they've done that because of the loyalty pricing questions or whether they've done it for other reasons, we don't know. But in terms of the pricing questions, we've done a lot of work across the book. We haven't focused yet on new propositions, partly because we think the big issues are about renewal customers rather than new business customers, and also because we do have a 3-year sort of fixed rate product with one of our partners, with RBS. And that's proved to work very effectively through where you're talking to people in a customer journey. less clear it works in a price comparison context, in sort of the commoditized end of the market, because to be economic, the new business prices have to be higher, effectively. So we're comfortable with the approach, and we just wait to see how successful some of those others. At the moment, our efforts are focusing elsewhere on the issue. It's not something we rule out. We do it elsewhere. If the market wants to support those kind of products, then, you know, we'll be happy to write them.
Just a quick question from John, then. Red to the phones.
Quick. You said you're pretty much there on the AUM decline. Does that mean you're also pretty much there on the SDR decline?
So I think we've said that they're both linked to similar things, reinsurance and size of business. So I think we said that it's probably a bit more, but I mean the material change, I think, is, we'd say, has changed in relation to that, to the risk profile part of the business.
Okay, operator, can we go to the line for any questions on the telephone line?
Okay, so we have our first question from Greg Pettison from KBW. Greg, your line is now open.
Morning, everybody. Four questions. Quick one is, could you give us the new money yield on investments? That's question one. Question two is the mix impacts, which have been hurting your top line. I was wondering when you think those are going to turn or stabilize or reverse. And the third thing, that's on UK motor rates. I was wondering if you could sort of characterize the difference in year-on-year premium rates at the beginning of the second quarter and at the end of the second quarter. So I'm trying to understand how the year-on-year rates have changed over. And then finally, in terms of general pricing in the motor market, is it everybody only moving slowly in terms of green shoots, or is there one or two players who are still being disruptive and going for share and that are clearly identifiable?
Welcome, Greg. We're missing you. So I'm going to do the last two. I might attempt the second one, and I wasn't quite sure the first one was. I'm going to give this now. So pricing in the market, and are we seeing? I think the home and the motor market are slightly different. I think the motor market is sort of, it seems to be moving. I don't think there's any one or two players that are standing out particularly that I draw sight to, and we keep seeing kind of little positives and, you know, what does that feel like? It feels like you put a change in or something and it sticks, as opposed to you losing. So we see every now little green shoots, and then we're not sure they're the same. So and perhaps your point three, what's that felt like? Year on year is difficult because rate was coming off quite fast at this point last year, or it was because of the shape of last year's rate. But if I, you know, I think that we were falling in the first quarter, and I'd characterize it as flatter in the second quarter, which I think the ABI graph actually probably sort of supports as well. But that would be our sentiment on the shape, I think. In home, I think there are always a couple of players doing sort of standing out. They're not always the same players. So the market is pricing sensibly. We are pricing sensibly. And then you've always got a couple of outliers that are going, usually smaller ones that are going for growth, and they chop and change over time. I think that's been a feature for the last year or so. Mix impact stabilised. I mean, the mix impacts that we see come through and kind of offset the AVP falls tend to be because we're taking initiative, be they, so we, I'll give you an example, we switched propositions from free rescue to free legal cover on Churchill. That changes the mix. We did it for profitability reasons, and but it does change the AVP mix and the risk mix. And equally, we've upgraded, I think we've talked to you before, some of the fraud models, the sort of application fraud models earlier in the year. Again, it's not targeting a particular mix, but it has an effect on mix. So I don't think, I wouldn't give you a particular direction on mix travel from here. Equally, I wouldn't say it's going to stay the same, because it depends what initiatives and propositions we put in place in the market at any point in time. And so you heard first.
Think, Greg, you want a new business, new money yields. So I've got them by Part of the portfolio is very different depending on where we're investing. So a weighted average one doesn't really help you because it depends on what's maturing and what you're reinvesting into. So what I'd say is to reiterate the answer I gave earlier, which is as we look into 2020, that when we reinvest what's coming out for maturity, we think we can still keep a 2% yield.
But I'm saying in the first half of this year, what did you achieve on new money? I appreciate there's a mixed effect as we go forward, but what did you achieve on new money in the first half?
I don't have it on me, but it's impressive within the numbers.
And just on the mixed point, are you saying you can't give any guidance and it could go up or could go down? It's a pretty random factor in the second half.
Yeah, it's not quite random, but it reflects the propositions and the targeting you do at that point in time. And it will also reflect what we view the competition in the market's doing. So if other people are chasing a particular part of the market, we may do something different. So it wouldn't be appropriate for me to tell you that it's going in one particular direction.
But is it true to say that you have a number of initiatives underway to try and address the negative mix impact that we've seen?
Yes, we have a number of initiatives underway. We don't target mix. So we target profitability outcome. We have a number of initiatives underway, and they may well affect mix and average premium in doing that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Greg. Operator, have you got anyone else on the line?
Our next question is from Andrew Sinclair from Bank of America. Andrew, your line is now open.
Morning, everyone. Just a couple on expenses for me, if that's okay. So firstly, just on expenses, how much of this year's operating expenses were one-off for IT and other developments? And secondly, just looking at what the run rate must be in H2 to get you under your $700 million target for the full year, and thinking how that rolls into 2020, can you commit to that expense base being lower in absolute terms again in 2020 than it was than it will be in 2019? Thanks.
Right. So the second one. The run rate in the second half will be lower. It naturally is because it's phasing. As I think we said, there's flood re in the first half, which is about £20 million. So if you look at the first half, second half split, historically, 20 to 30, sometimes even bigger gap between the first half and second half. So I think there's nothing in there that it should be standard run rate. As we look forward into 2020, I think we should be targeting lower costs in 2020 versus 2019. So yes. In terms of the one-off in there, I don't think I'd call anything particularly one-off in there. A lot of the transformation costs are capitalized, as you'll see in the intangible assets. There always is additional cost when you're running a lot of transformation programs. But I wouldn't necessarily say it's one-off at the moment. I think we're going to be running some transformations for the next couple of years.
Thanks.
Any other questions on the line?
Our next question is from Johnny Yerwin from UBS. Johnny, your line is now open. Oh, Johnny's just come off of the line. Johnny, if you'd like to ask again, it's star one. But I'll move on to the next question. It's Joanna Parsons from Canaccord. Joanna, your line is now open.
Thanks very much. Two quick questions from me. Just in terms of your comments on dual pricing and that you've been reviewing the way you've been treating renewal and new customers at the year end. When did you start doing that review? Has that been a long-term process or was it post the ABI calling for that to be done? And then the second question is FX. Is that going to have much of a negative impact for you, do you think, on claims costs in terms of repair costs for parts?
So job pricing. So we've had a pricing framework in place for some years, including a renewal point review at 5 years. So in that sense, it's been a long-term thing. We continue to review the lines and the positioning of sort of and approaches that we take within that framework, because what you're trying to do over time is kind of improve the situation and even the situation. So we tighten as we go, if that makes sense. But it's not a new process. We do work with the ABI continuously, keep making improvements so that all the industry, including ourselves, are improving both transparency and, you know, any tail risk in it over time. So that, I think, is the dual pricing. FX,
clearly, sterling devaluation or reduction in investment does increase inflation. Some damaged parts, but I wouldn't overcall the impact of it.
Okay. Thank you. Next up, we have Johnny Yerwin from UBS. Johnny, your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Can you hear me?
Yep. Welcome, Johnny.
Wonderful. Thank you. Sorry not to be there. Just to go back to the FCA pricing investigation, I mean, have you changed any of your renewal pricing practices specifically this year, you know, ahead of the interim and full year findings that we're going to get? It's hard to gauge, like, at the market level, is some element of the pricing weakness that we're seeing, you know, from the ABI print this week, is some of that because renewal pricing is coming down a bit, just as people clean things up ahead of the FCA? Any color there would be great. Thank you.
Look, we continue to make changes. In our pricing, sort of not directly in a response to any particular communication from the FCA or anyone else, but because we have pricing practices that have been and principles that we've been moving down the path. And like the rest of the ABI members, we've introduced and reflected the pricing principles agreed there, and those keep moving through. So we are constantly making improvements in the book, and our numbers will reflect those improvements already. So I think that's my thing. I can't comment on what other people are doing. It still feels competitive out there, so it's not obvious that anything dramatic is happening, but I can't comment on what other people are or aren't doing on pricing for that.
Brilliant. Thanks.
Next up, we have Phil Ross from Mediobanca. Phil, your line is now open.
Morning all, Phil Ross from Mediobanca. Just one question left from me, please, which is a bit of a follow-up on top line, so apologies for that. You talked at the start of the presentation about your future ability to grow sustainably, I think were the words you used. What's your view on when we might start to see sustainable growth in the top line, and what kind of role might partnerships play in that growth? Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. I think we are, I think I said it in one of the Q&As earlier, what we're trying to build is competitive advantage that then gives us choices as to what we take as bottom line and growth depending at any point in time on what the market is doing. So we believe that when you combine those with some of the newer initiatives and so on, that there is growth potential. We absolutely do. As we sit in the market today, in the short term, our priority will always be discipline. So we just need to watch that dynamic at the moment. So I don't want to point to what that growth back will be in the short term. Partnerships are more binary. That's the, they're a bit of an on-off switch. So yes, we would be in the partnership arena. Yes, we think the partnerships will evolve in their shape over time. That, I think, is early days, that evolution. We've just renewed two partnerships on travel, which proves that we're still actively participating in that marketplace.
Okay, thank you.
We have no further questions on the line.
Thank you very much. I think, unless there's any urgent questions, which you can probably catch us afterwards, we're probably running out of time. So thank you very much.
I just say thank you very, very much for fighting through the tube lines. And remind you, the presentation, the script will be online for anyone who missed the beginning. So thank you.